going to stand up for what you believe, or are you going to compromise that to win Miss USA?
The president is somebody who prays each and every day, whether it's National Prayer Day or not.
Protect the dignity of every human person, the sanctity of human life from the tiny baby in the womb.
Hold up your Bible. Say it like you mean it. This is my Bible. I am what it says I am. I have what it says I have. I can do what it says I can do. I will never be the same. God bless you.
Thank you for providing theology for clerical collar, white collar, and blue collar.
Well, the entire idea of America was conceived in an age very different from ours today. An age when they could actually contemplate sending 100 men into a room of men of very different opinion, and to deliberate, even debate, in a very measured way, the great ideas and the great actions of the day. They conceived of our government as that kind of a civil body, not just civil in the broader sense, but civil in the sense of actually being able to disagree with one another, still get along, and actually still get things done. And that seems almost impossible in the America of today. What does that mean for the world? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Our call-in number live this Monday afternoon, the 4th of May, as we talk about pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture with Oz Guinness, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, and our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Oz Guinness is a regular guest. He's a social critic, speaker, and author of more than 25 books, including The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Oz, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you. Pleasure to be back.
You can understand the skepticism, the suspicion that some may have in a call for civility, because especially from the Christian perspective, it seems that so many of the calls for civility today are really calls for compromise. How do you respond?
No, I understand that. And that's one of the strongest criticisms of the idea, but it's based on a misunderstanding. And interestingly, not only fundamentalists think that, but also fundamentalists who are atheists. Richard Dawkins doesn't like the idea of civility because he believes he'll have to tolerate religious people. Now, let me put it like this, Todd. The right to believe anything does not mean that anything anyone believes is right. The first half of that sentence is freedom of conscience. And the theological argument behind that is the doctrine of hell. The right to believe anything is absolute in terms of belief. But that, of course, doesn't mean anything anyone believes is right. People with a right to freedom of conscience may believe things that are half-baked or confused or socially disastrous or maybe even morally profoundly evil. In other words, we can disagree with them. In fact, we have a responsibility to disagree with them, but to do so civility, with respect, and so on.
You say that the pursuit of a new civility must begin with the United States. You're not a Native American. Why do you think it must begin with the U.S.?
Well, I'm not American. I'm European. I'm not American now. But put it like this. Broadly speaking, there are three regions in the world. There's the U.S., where for 230-odd years, you've got a tremendous tradition of tackling these issues. Then you've got Western European countries, including Australia and so on, where you have some of the first principles of freedom, but they don't have much history of dealing with it, partly because many of the Western European countries are homogeneous and have never really struggled with diversity. And then you've got other parts of the world, for instance, China as an atheist country, or many of the Middle Eastern countries as Islamic, where there's absolutely no inclination because of their atheism as an ideology or their Islam, no inclination to respect freedom of conscience at all. So with our history in this country, with our first principles that are so rich, if we can't get it right here, who can? And that's why I challenge Americans. We've got to show the rest of the world how it can be done. But I'm not a fool. I'm not naive. It can't be, say, exported to the Middle East easily. But we've got to demonstrate a better way.
Someone would say, look, Oz, your idea is great, And I think we can have the kind of civility that you're talking about as long as certain subjects are left off the table, namely religious ideas. You say we can't leave them off the table. They have to be at the center of the table. Why?
Well, we've got to distinguish what we talk about in the public square. In the public square, we talk about the issues that are of common public interest to citizens of all backgrounds. I don't think the public square, and there's a difference between the public square and the public sphere and public life, I don't think the public square is the place to be talking about the differences between, say, the Christian faith and Islam or Christian faith and atheism. I think that's much better left in the private world. In other words, it's not the roots of our differences that we should be arguing in the public square. It's the results of our differences and the consequences for our common public life.
You said there's a difference between the public square and the public sphere. What's the difference there?
Well, the public square is the metaphor for what the Greeks used to call the agora, or the Romans the forum, where people specifically got together to talk about citizens' common life. Now, the public sphere, in other words, the world outside the private sphere of our home, that's a huge area. We can talk about what we like in all sorts of areas of the public sphere. But the public square is a metaphor when we're talking about things that are more political, that are to do with our common life, as I said.
What's the role of the American First Amendment in your thinking about a kind of a model for civility?
Well, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all on this issue. In other words, every nation has its own history and its own background and its own way of doing things. What matters is that every nation should take fundamental first principle human rights, such as freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and work out how they applied them. Now, the First Amendment is America's great achievement in this. Now, the trouble is even the interpretation of the First Amendment has got mired down in the culture warring since the early 1960s with the rise of strict separationism and so on. So the First Amendment is not doing as well as it should. And to me, that's the tragedy of America at the moment. When the framers said this country was the new order of the ages, the novus ordo seclorum, much of the world wasn't terribly interested. They didn't need the answers that America had thrown up in wrestling with these gigantic modern problems. But now, the same problems are sweeping the world, such as the problem of living with our deep differences in a deeply diverse society. And many countries, when I was a boy in England, England was incredibly homogeneous, relatively speaking. Now, it's more diverse than America. And so people in Europe are looking at the United States, and when they do, looking for answers, Americans aren't doing so well. And that's the tragedy.
Just a bit of history here before we go to this break. When, in your mind, historically, was the pact broken that was made there in the early American mind but doesn't seem to survive very well with regard to civility today?
Well, Todd, I put it that the framers got race badly wrong. They got the place of women badly wrong. But they did get religious liberty almost nearly right from the beginning. So I would say from the First Amendment, 1791, right down to the Everson case in 1947, there were egregious violations and things changed, but there was a general agreement as to what the American settlement was. So the crucial year, I see, it was 1947 with the rise of strict separationism in the Everson case. And then that was compounded by Madeline Murray O'Hare pressing that with the attempts to get school prayer out of public schools in the early 60s. And then with the rise of the religious right, the culture warring was enjoined. The rest is history.
Many Christians, fundamentalists and evangelicals, bemoan the loss of what they think was a more homogeneous, perhaps pristine age in America where there was the discourse on big ideas in the public square took place more easily, except, of course, those exceptions you just mentioned, took place more easily because they imagined that the culture was in some way essentially Christian. Is that true?
Well, certainly in the 19th century, the culture was broadly Protestant, and it was Catholics and Jews who felt somewhat squeezed out in the public schools. But the openness of American society assumes and requires that those who want to influence public life have to see their opinions prevail, which means they have to be persuasive. And you can see recently tiny groups like, say, the gays have actually been much more persuasive in American public life than huge majorities like Christians. So if we don't persuade, we can't hope to prevail. And that's the conundrum that Christians face. So they can't complain if the consensus disappears. And that's right. Public life has grown decidedly more secular, and the private sphere has grown decidedly more pluralistic and diverse. But as that happens, that means we've got to engage all the more, be all the more persuasive if we hope to prevail. And if we don't persuade, we can't hope to prevail. We can't just complain.
We're talking with Oz Guinness, a social critic, speaker, and author of more than 25 books, including The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It, about civility, pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture. He joins us live from Washington, D.C. this Monday afternoon, the 4th of May. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. We're giving away this book, Oz Guinness' new book, The Case for Civility, to listeners with the best questions or comments in this hour, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Why have Christians been unable to persuade lately? We'll talk about that after this.
Of civility, my friend.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Talking with Oz Guinness this Monday afternoon, the 4th of May, about pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture. You can join us with questions or comments right here in the studio. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Or give us a call, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. How is it then, Oz, that Christians have lost the ability, or perhaps it may just be the will, to persuade?
Well, I think over the decades, we've just rested on the ease of having a Christian consensus. So, you know, when America did have such a consensus, it was as if everyone, even if they weren't Christian, could at least talk Christian. And we assumed that, and so we talked easily. Our authority, the Bible, was the accepted authority, and so on. But that's all gone. And we have not been good in knowing how to mix in a very pluralistic age. Take, say, same-sex marriage. You know the famous painting by Grant Wood, American Gothic, of the couple with a rather dour face with a pitchfork in their hand. You know, I often think many of the Christian arguments I've heard against same-sex marriage are rather like that painting. I believe in one man, one woman, marriage, boom, and they stick in the pitchfork. But just as the Apostle Paul preached the Torah, the Old Testament, in the synagogue, and then went to Mars Hill and used Cretan poets and so on, and spoke with a very different argument, so we've got to make arguments that are flexible depending who we're talking to. And Christians have lost this capacity to persuade.
It occurs to me, hearing you say that, Oz, that the 16th century Reformation, especially Luther's insight, drawing from Scripture, this distinction between what he would have called the right-hand government, left-hand government, or the kingdom of the left, the kingdom of the right, that distinction where God rules in the church by the means of grace toward the forgiveness of sins, but he rules also in the state through human agencies, through reason and force, that distinction might be very helpful here for Christians today. Do you concur?
Well, I think so, yes, except they didn't have democracy then, and that's the difference.
That's true.
Democracy assumes a huge number of voices, and those who want to win, you know, have to go out and be persuasive. Now, the same thing is true in elections. You know, if the Republicans don't do well, the Democrats get in. If the Democrats don't do well, the Republicans get in. Now, we expect that. And if a side is beaten one time, they make sure that they're not beaten the next time, they're better. Now, transfer that to many of our Christian arguments. When William Wilberforce entered the ring, as it were, put in boxing terms, against slavery, he was defeated 20 years in a row. And then he won. And 47 years later, he won for good and banished slavery from the British Empire. And Christians have got to think like that. We've got to get in there and become persuasive.
You've written a lot about the anti-intellectualist bent of American evangelicalism. Is this part of the reason that Christians haven't been persuasive?
Well, that doesn't help. I mean, the people you had on the air in our break, say Robbie George and so on, they are Catholic intellectuals who have a tremendous tradition and are very intellectually persuasive. Now, thank God, we've got a tremendous group of young evangelicals arising who are equally sharp and are becoming persuasive, and I'm delighted to witness that. But we haven't been, generally speaking, and our anti-intellectualism is not only a sin. This is the way I put it. It's not only a sin. We're not loving the Lord with our minds as well as our hearts. It's also a very severe cultural handicap.
Well, speaking of intellectuals, the late Father Richard John Newhouse, a frequent guest on this program, and I think in many ways the model of the kind of civility you may be talking about, coined the phrase decades back, the naked public square. Late in your book, you take some exception with that term. You talk about a sacred public square and is no better an idea than the naked public square. What do you mean by this?
Well, I don't take exception with his term. It's a brilliant term to describe what's happening. I take exception with the thing, the phenomenon. In other words, you got on one side the sacred public square. They were those who would like to see their religion preferred and privileged in public life, like the supporters of school prayer. And on the other side, you have the naked public square, the strict separationists, some of whom are secularists, sadly some of whom were originally Baptists, but people who would like to see the public square cleansed antiseptically of all religion. In other words, make faith private and make the public square secular. And for a whole number of reasons, that's absolutely disastrous. I agree strongly with Richard Newhouse. The naked public square is a disaster.
What should we aim at, if not sacred or naked? What is the middle way, if you will?
Well, both Richard and I agreed on this solidly. The middle position is a civil public square. Now, the trouble is, as you began, Todd, as you knew, civility has become a sort of wimp word, something that maybe is connected with tea party etiquette or dinner party manners or whatever. Whereas civility, properly understood, is a republican virtue with a small r and a democratic necessity. And this is how I describe it. A vision of a civil public square is a vision in which everyone of all faiths, Christians, Jews, atheists, Muslims, Scientologists, you name it, everyone of all faiths are free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith. That's freedom of conscience. But, and here's the big but, within a framework of what is understood and agreed and taught, family to family in public schools and so on, to be just and free for people of other faiths too. So a right for a Christian is a right for a Jew and a responsibility for both of them, and so on.
You raise three big questions early in the book where they're basically questions about the state of the world with regard to some of the big ideas that have been or will be. And the first one you ask is, will Islam modernize peacefully, forswearing its tendency toward militancy, pacifying its violent extremists, reversing its very low view of women, acknowledging the right of religious liberty for all, including those Muslims who convert to other faiths? Why is this one of the biggest pressing questions in a world of civility today?
Well, just take, say, Islam and human rights. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was 60 years ago in December. Since then, Saudi Arabia, which was the only nation at the time to abstain from signing the Universal Declaration, Saudi Arabia has systematically tried to undermine human rights in one of two ways, either by having Islamic rights, which begin by sounding good, but then you realize they're all within the framework of the Sharia, so they're really undermined for people who are not Muslims, or by passing laws or things through the United Nations that are against the defamation of religion. In other words, they try to protect religions, not believers. They protect beliefs, not believers. And that really undermines freedom of conscience and human rights. So religiously speaking, the Saudi spearheaded efforts are the greatest threats to freedom of conscience we have in the world today.
Joe is listening in St. Louis. Joe, thank you for waiting on the line.
Hey, thanks for having me on. My question is kind of in the same vein of what you guys were talking about right there. I was wondering if you could expect or even hope to achieve public civility in a system that does not accept that all of humanity is equal sinners under God, and that, you know, you see this in militant atheists, and you see it in people who have atheist points of view with key positions in the government, such as high universe or in society, such as higher universities, bar associations, things like that, in which they pushing an atheist view is rewarded and holding back a Christian one is, or using that position to push a Christian point of view is punished. Thanks.
Joe, thank you very much. Oz, a couple minutes to respond.
Yes, I mean, obviously to many people, militant violence from the Islamic extremists is the great threat. But in fact, there are two threats, and the other threat is the submerged threat of secularists in the West who actually deny freedom of conscience. It's not just they disagree with Christians or Jews or Muslims. They deny freedom of conscience. And you can see this very strongly in a very important institution in America like the State Department. There are knots in American life of secularists, some of whom don't realize how tone-deaf they are, and they're the ones who are actually undermining freedom of conscience in ways that are very dangerous. So people who fight for human rights and for freedom of conscience in particular have to do it against Islamic extremism, but also against secular extremism.
You actually coin a term, perhaps unintentionally, where you talk about state-favored European secularism. I'm wondering, what should America be doing looking toward its European neighbors, wondering what lies in the future for us if they see this there?
Well, Todd, put it this way. When you see the arguments of many people in the State Department or some of the new atheists and so on in this country, they're really very close to the French style of laicity, as the French call it, in other words, secularity, that the framers resisted. But let me put it another way, because most of your audience, I imagine, are Christians, as I am. You would think Europe is the most secular continent in the world. It's true. And the main reason is that Europe has corrupt state churches in the past. And America never has that problem because of the genius of disestablishment. But since the rise of the culture warring 40 years ago and the religious right 30 years ago, you can see a steadily mounting American equivalent of the European repudiation of religion among the educated classes in America. Now, if this sets in concrete, it'll be incredibly fateful for America, and Christians will have been partly to blame.
I want to talk more about that on the other side of the break. That's a fascinating thesis from our guest, Oz Guinness. He's author of the book, The Case for Civility, and Why Our Future Depends on It. He joins us live from Washington, D.C. this Monday, May the 4th. You can join us as well. 25 more minutes on the other side of this break. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MY-IE. Or email us right here in the studio. talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Oz Guinness is our guest. We're talking about pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture. He's a social critic, speaker, and author of more than 25 books, including his latest, The Case for Civility. We're giving this book away to the best callers or emailers during this hour. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE, or talkback@issuesetc.org. By the way, when you purchase The Case for Civility using the Amazon.com link under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, a portion of your purchase goes to benefit the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Oz, you said something before the break that I want you to explain. You talked about how from the inception of the culture wars about 30 years ago, about 40 years ago, the rise of the Christian right, there has been a steady increase in a hardened kind of secularism and atheism in the United States, akin to what we find already full-blown in Western Europe. Are you suggesting that Christians disengage on the great moral, ethical, legal, biblical issues of the day?
Todd, not for one second. But I'm suggesting that we fight, as it were, inverted commas, Christianly. In other words, you look, we are, as Christians, we're followers of Jesus. What are some of the distinctives of the way he called his followers to live? Well, we're to forgive without limit. We're to return good for wrong. And supremely, we're to love our enemies. Now, Wilberforce did that, and he was persuasive. In one day, and he was a man who had, you know, his opponents set people on him in the streets physically trying to mug him. I mean, he was vilified uphill and down dale. One day when one of his opponents, his enemies, died, he saw to it quietly that the man's widow was given a pension. He was always gracious. Now, you compare that with much of the tactics of the religious right, where they stereotype and demonize in awful ways. You look at the stuff that's coming out from Christians now about Obama being the Antichrist. You look at the fear-mongering and the alarmism. It is not only sub-Christian, it's anti-Christian. And so we're giving grounds for the very thing that we fear. And you can see with the rise of the new atheists, they're just the sharp end. Look, read, say, Kevin Phillips' American Theocrats, or Christopher Hedges, an American fascists. What they see is not just Islam in the far distance. They see the Christian right. Now, some of their perceptions are distorted and skewed, I admit. I argue against them when I'm actually with them face to face. But you can see that they're keying off Christian brothers and sisters who have not been behaving Christianly. And that's a tragedy. The Christian right, in many ways, has been a disaster for all of us.
What went wrong in the culture wars?
Well, a lot of things, Todd, but you could just start by saying what I've just said. They didn't live Christianly. Yeah, but leave that on one side. Another huge mistake of the Christian right, they trusted politics to do more than politics can do. Now, the technical term for that is politicization. And you can see that America has been politicized really since the Roosevelt years in the 1930s, and many, many groups have asked politics to do more than politics can do. But the idea, if we get our people in, so you take the recent Bush administration, never have evangelicals been so high. The president, a secretary of state, two attorney generals, the speaker of the House, you go on down the line. Almost all of them accused of being inept, and one of them accused of being corrupt. Never have evangelicals been so high and actually achieved so little. And this is part of politicization. Now, the much more realistic idea in Washington, by people like Mark Rogers and others, they've been saying for 10 years, Washington is downstream. The real damage in our culture comes from the universities or from Hollywood and other places. So the bodies are dead when they're floating by Washington. So the idea you can go to Washington and turn the culture around is just foolish. It's naive.
Well, that was exactly my next question. I'm wondering, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, formerly of World Magazine, now of Patrick Henry College, suggests that one of the problems is that while Christians claim to have been manning the walls in the culture war, they really have abandoned their post, especially in academia, where the next generation is being formed. What do you think?
Well, I think Ed Veith is exactly right. In other words, if we really take seriously not politicization, but the biblical notion of calling, the Lord's given each of us gifts, spheres of influence, our own distinctive, unique callings. If we do that, some are computer scientists, some are homemakers, some should be university professors, some filmmakers, and so on. Then we could really see the salt being salty and turning the culture around. It's the Lord who deploys his people, not someone saying, we should all get into politics today or whatever.
Okay, you talk also about the global square and how it makes the pursuit of civility, beginning with the United States, all the more necessary. How am I to picture the global square? Where do I see this at work?
Well, let's be clear. The public square is a Western idea. You know, the Greeks put it out there, the Agora. You can see it in Athens, a literal place. But then in the Anglo-Saxon democracies, it became a metaphor. It wasn't just Parliament and Congress. It included the op-ed pages of the paper and so on. But what we're seeing, and this is since the rise of the computer, is the beginning, only the beginnings, the outlines of an emerging global public square. And the way I put it is this. You take, say, the Danish cartoon controversy or the responses of the Muslims to the Pope's speech at Regensburg. In the age of the Internet, even when we're not consciously speaking to the world, we can be heard by the world. I could say something incredibly insulting this afternoon to Muslims or Hindus, and you could have a response tomorrow from Cairo or from New Delhi or wherever. That's our world. When we're not speaking to the world, it can roar around the world quickly and be picked up by the world. And you can see the beginnings of an emerging global public square. How do we speak civilly in such a world?
What is the future if this civility cannot be restored or regained or however we want to put it? What is the future of the integrity of the U.S. Constitution, not only the First Amendment, but the integrity of the entire U.S. Constitution?
Well, I don't think it's just the Constitution that's at stake. It's the American Republic that's at stake. In other words, the Republic assumes and requires the vitality of citizens with their views of what's free, human, just, good, etc., entering the public square and being able to do so. If that's blocked from one end or the other, and at the moment it's more likely to be from the secular side in this country, then the Republic will wither. And there's no question. America's got to get this right in this generation. The way I put it is this. I quote the wonderful little line from Tocqueville. He said, you know, he was a great admirer of the American Revolution, as I am. But he was a disappointed lover of his own country's revolution, France. And he made this little remark, with a revolution, as with a novel, the hard part to invent is the ending. In other words, Americans listening, the first chapter on religious liberty and freedom of conscience was brilliant, the most nearly perfect system the world's seen so far. And there have been violations since then. There have been great stirring chapters since then. But the present chapter is a mess, the culture warring, which religion is the holy war front. And I would say bluntly, this generation's got to get this right, or within 50 years, the American Republic will decline. It's as simple and fundamental as that.
Recently at his, I believe it was the announcement of his retirement from Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson, a man of considerable influence in American evangelicalism and otherwise, bemoaned what he said was the loss of the culture war on a lot of the issues. Do you agree that they've been lost?
Certainly we're not prevailing, but it's not over. As I said, Wilberforce was defeated for 20 years. Now, our situation is different because we once had a consensus. In other words, we were once the status quo, and we've lost it. And certainly the tide is flowing the other way. But it's partly our fault by the unwisdom and the extremism and the sub-Christian ways it's been fought, including the lack of persuasion. We can't expect to win, but it could be turned around within 10 years.
We're talking.
We'll
come back to that on the other side of the break. Oz Guinness is our guest. We'll have him share that recollection with us on the other side. I do want to hear from you. We're giving away Oz Guinness' new book called The Case for Civility to listeners with the best questions or comments. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can give us a call, 10 more minutes with Oz Guinness, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. live this Monday afternoon, the 4th of May. We'll also talk with Oz about the Williamsburg Charter. It's a suggestion. It's a reflection and, in some ways, a celebration, a reaffirmation of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. How does having an eternal perspective aid the Christian in the case for everyday ordinary civility in the public square? We'll also answer that question on the other side of the break. I want to hear your questions, too. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-6943, or talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Oz Guinness is a social critic, speaker, and author of more than 25 books, including The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. He joins us live from Washington, D.C. We're talking about pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture. 1-877-623-6943. Tomorrow on the program, we'll visit with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service. Stay tuned.
I got my cloak of civility. Got my coat.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Oz Guinness is our guest. We've got 10 more minutes on this Monday afternoon, May the 4th. Talking about pursuing civility in a post-Christian culture, 1-877-623-6943, or talkback@issuesetc.org. Oz, I'm curious, how do you think the conservative media in the United States, be it television, radio, print, how have they done in terms of either modeling or pursuing the kind of civility you envision?
I don't think very well, and I think many of them have been concerned to do well, and I'm not sure either side has. And so, you know, each side excuses what it does by saying that the other side's worse. But what that does is just ratchet up the problem one degree further.
Some of it sounds like cheerleading to me, as though we're not really trying to persuade anybody, but we're simply trying to reaffirm ideas already held.
No, that's right. And that's sadly, with the collapse of the old-line newspapers, that's what's coming in the age of the Internet. People in their own niches, you know, seeking the reaffirmation of what they already believe, whether it's spiritual or political or whatever. And you don't have a lot of citizenship debate that's genuine. You know, John Courtney Murray used to point out that disagreement is an achievement because you know what you each believe and you know where you differ from people. But very often we just speak to people on our own side today and slam the other side. So you can say, look at Fox News or then MSNBC, and, you know, each side has its own supporters. And this is the balkanization of America, people in their own little bubbles.
Our newly minted president, President Barack Obama, entered office high on the hopes of many that not only would civility be restored, but also a new kind of American hope. What kind of challenge does really face him in the office he now occupies?
Well, it's a truism here in Washington that he faces a range and a scale of problems that are unprecedented for 60 or 70 years. So, you know, in lots of areas, this is a sour and fractious time. You know, but I'm European, as you know, but I'm here first and foremost as a Christian. I'm appalled. I mentioned earlier the alarmism and the fear-mongering among Christians. I think it's absolutely appalling. The most repeated admonition in Scripture, not only in Jesus, but the prophets in the Old Testament and the New Testament, have no fear. And yet many Christian spokesmen today are the sources of a terrible fear-mongering. And we should be ashamed of ourselves. It's time we had a renewal in the evangelical community and a return to living the way Jesus called his followers to live.
One of the things that I've found disturbing, and maybe I'm just old-fashioned, is often, even inadvertently, when we refer to political leaders that we don't like, we call them by their last names without any proper reference to who or what office they occupy. We'll say Obama, Clinton, Carter, etc. A dishonor we don't afford those with whom we agree.
Mm-hmm. No, these are little telltale signs. I mean, good manners. I was talking to someone after going down to Texas A&M, which I was told was like a throwback to the 1950s, where people opened the door for women and they said good morning as they walk across the lawn. And he was the friendliest, politest place I've been to on an American campus. And a lot of people poo-poo manners like that. But actually, they're very important. What I'm talking about, civility, is far deeper than that when we talk about respect for freedom of conscience. But even good manners, like you're mentioning, are very, very important. And no one is clearer than that than George Washington.
Steve is listening in St. Louis. Steve, thanks for waiting.
Hey, not a problem. One of the things I've noticed is that you can't have disagreements with people because what happens is instead of being able to discuss issues, if you disagree with them, they're taking it almost as it's a personal affront to them, as a personal insult, to the point where when you start discussing issues, you suddenly find yourself at an emotional level, and suddenly, even if you try to do a little discourse, many times it ends up in this tit-for-tat argument.
Steve, thank you very much. Tremendous insight. Oz?
No, Steve's made a tremendous point. I think this is the result of a century of American therapeutic style of living. You know, one of the things I noticed moving from Europe to here the first month I was here, in Europe you can have a knockdown, drag-out argument, debate with someone, and at the end of an hour you can part as great friends. Whereas here, after about 5 minutes, as Steve's suggesting, you know, if you disagree with someone radically, they'll say, well, you're not respecting me, you're dissing me, or I feel insulted, I feel called into question, and so on. And we fall into psychological therapeutic categories. And then, of course, that came into politics through the dreadful notion of victim playing. You know, I'm more victimized than thou, and if I can be the victim and you're insulting me, then I gain that way. But this is all disastrous. We need to learn to have tough, knockdown, drag-out debates, respecting each other's rights to believe what we believe, but being candid about our disagreements when they're important.
So,
Steve makes a great point.
I look at the British Parliament, the way that these people will have a discussion, which looks like to us like an argument, and yet things actually get discussed. Actually open disagreement and opinion is really discussed without – it doesn't look civil, but it seems to me perhaps more civil than what we have in the U.S.
Well, sadly, it's on television now, so it's beginning to get towards the grandstanding and the spectacle playing, which is a shame. But the great difference is, if you look at Congress, very often people are making speeches and there's nobody there. In other words, the camera just focuses on them, but if the camera is to draw back, you see the chamber's empty. It's just total posturing. Whereas the House of Commons, for better or worse, despite the grandstanding for television, the House of Commons is a real debate. The room is filled, and they're arguing with each other. And I think it's a very different system. And we need to get back to that. And as Christians, I love the way, say, the Veritas Forum. It's very strong in going on to campuses and inviting a symphony of voices, different Christian voices, but let's have atheists and others giving their views so the Christian faith is seen in contrast to some of these others. And I think we've got to have a fearlessness and a boldness and an assurance because we believe in the truth of the gospel. And so we're quite prepared to mix it like that.
Several quick final questions. First of all, when we encounter kind of that anger or disrespect in the public square, how do we respond to it in a way that models genuine civility?
With love. Obviously, our motive is not just to be civil. It's far deeper to speak the truth with love, to have truth and grace, as it was said of our Lord. So we love even our enemies, certainly people we're debating against.
Give me the Williamsburg Charter in 30 seconds.
It's a vision of public life which solves the culture warring and gives the rights for people of all faiths to enter and engage public life. But it goes on and shows how practically that happens. Now, it's not just a celebration.
Finally, then, how can Christians who possess an eternal perspective on all these matters, how can this eternal perspective aid us in practicing genuine civility?
Well, we have assurance that even if we're defeated this year in an election or over some issue, that God's truth one day will triumph. So we should be without any fear, with complete humility and with love for our enemies, just be tireless in persisting and going out, because one day we know God will have the last word.
Oz Guinness is a social critic, speaker, and author of more than 25 books, including The Case for Civility and Why Our Future Depends on It. He joined us live from Washington, D.C. Oz, thank you very much for your time.
Enormous pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Steve from St. Louis, give us a call back. We're going to send you a copy of The Case for Civility by Oz Guinness. I like the way he's thinking, especially that whole fear not thing. Do we need to fear the public square and a genuine engagement with ideas different from our own, with which we differ and will remain in disagreement? Do we need to fear that engagement when we know that we have the truth on our side? Now, I know that in the postmodern culture in which we live, saying that you have the truth on your side is considered to be the height, the pinnacle of arrogance. But as Christians, whether we like it or not, we do have the truth on our side. That doesn't mean that whatever we do, we can claim to be true. But that means as long as we are in accord with God's word, then we do have the truth on our side. So we do not need to fear the engagement with ideas that are false. We do not need to fear the debate and the conversation. We can engage in it civilly. Why? Because when the truth is on our side, we not only need not fear, but we can also afford to be civil. If we're desperate, we're scratching and clawing toward ideas that we aren't sure are true, then of course we're going to appear desperate in our public debate. But when we know that the truth is on our side and that God's truth ultimately does win out, then we can afford the time and the energy to love our neighbor. We can afford to be patient, and we can afford to be civil with everyone, those with whom we agree, those with whom we disagree. I've said for a long time that one of the biggest problems in the Christian church, not to mention outside the Christian church, is that we've forgotten how to disagree with one another without immediately assigning the other person the most sinister and darkest of motives. You know, sometimes those with whom we disagree, those who do us harm, those who do not even mean us well, do it thinking they're doing the right thing. And even if they don't, even if their motives are dark and sinister indeed, we can still afford to be civil and love one another. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.